Israel thinks that Iran poses an existential threat to their existence. I don't think Iran's ever attacked Israel. As I said, Israel's the only country that has nuclear weapons. In terms of the United States, Trump has basically turned over his Israel policy, not just to Netanyahu, but also to Pompeo, Mike Pompeo and Mike Pence, who are self-identified evangelicals. Mm-hmm. And the Christian Zionists believe that Jesus is not going to return until the temple in Jerusalem is rebuilt. And that's going to happen only if it remains under Jewish rather than Palestinian control. And, you know, so this is, and of course, what Jews don't understand when they support this is that if you take this scenario to its logical conclusion, the Jews either convert to Christianity or they get killed.
Hey, everybody. Thank you very much for tuning in. I just want to say before we jump in, I received a really excellent voicemail through my Drop Me a Line feature. I'm actually going to be featuring that call and my response to that call at the end of this episode. This interview that I'm going to be presenting here in a moment with Marjorie Cohn is only about 30 minutes long, so I thought what I would do is just put the call at the very end of the episode and then respond to it. If you look down in the description of this episode, you will find timestamps, you'll find when this interview begins, and you'll also find when my response to this Drop Me a Line call will begin as well. But in this episode, I speak with Marjorie Cohn. She is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. She's the former president of the National Lawyers Guild, Deputy Secretary General of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, and a member of the Advisory Board for Veterans for Peace. And her most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. She writes regularly on her website, and she publishes much of that on Truthout, which is how I became aware of her work, in large part just from reading her really excellent articles that she has published there. Two articles in particular that I reference is Will Trump's Attempt to Subvert the Election Results Succeed? And the second one, which is published more recently, is titled Trump's Support for Israel's Killing of Iranian Scientists Could Lead to War. So those are really the two main subjects of this 30-minute interview with Marjorie. The first, of course, I ask her to explain all the various routes, the various ways in which the Trump administration, the Trump team, has attempted to pull off what we call an electoral coup. We're still seeing this play out. I recorded this interview a little over a week ago. I wanted to release this a little sooner, but I got slightly overwhelmed with, you know, getting out the interviews with those local nurses here in the Magic Valley in Southern Idaho. Also, my previous interview I just did with Jared Yates Sexton, which we talk about a lot of similar subjects with Marjorie. But I think Marjorie, what she did is she really defines and details exactly how the electoral process works in the United States with the Electoral College system. So as I mentioned with those previous episodes, I got a little overwhelmed getting those out because I feel like all the things that I talked about with those nurses, with Jared Yates Sexton, as well as with Marjorie, these are all very relevant presently. Trying to get these out as soon as I can without being completely overwhelmed with all the little details required to do that. So, but I'm really happy that I got to speak with Marjorie because she really cleared a lot of things up for me in regards to how Trump and his cronies are really attempting something that hasn't ever happened, as far as I know, in U.S. history, which is trying to effectively overthrow and throw out the legitimate results of an election in order to keep him in power for another term, at least. As of right now, I'm recording this on December 11th. Everything that Marjorie said, of course, is completely true and very relevant and all of that. But, you know, it's been a little bit over a week and things are moving so quickly that I just want to say that, you know, we are closing in on the results of this election being finalized. And it's going to be really interesting, to say the very least, to see how Trump and his allies attempt to continue to do what they're doing, which is delegitimize this election. Even if the majority of the U.S. population doesn't believe in what Trump is doing, there is a significant portion of the U.S. population that are fanatical devotees of Trump. And that is something that we should be very concerned with, because regardless of whether Trump stays in power or not this coming January, and it seems very unlikely that he will be able to pull that off, in spite of that, he will still be a political force, and his base will continue to be a political force in the coming years. I mean, this isn't over just because Biden won, and it seems that the coup attempt is not going to be successful ultimately. That doesn't change the fact that this is deeply consequential for what's going to be happening politically and socially over the next several years. But we talk about that in the first part of this interview, and then we move into what I mentioned with her second article, which addresses the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist, and that was on November 27th. As she wrote in her article, although the Israeli government has not claimed credit for the illegal killing, there is little doubt of its culpability. Trump implicitly praised the assassination, retweeting a comment by Israeli journalist and intelligence expert Yossi Melman that the killing was a, quote, major psychological and professional blow, end quote, to Iran. This was an, quote, implicit approval if there ever was one, end quote, according to Sina Tusi, a senior research analyst at the National Iranian American Council. So I asked her about this event where, like I just mentioned and quoted there, there was an attempt, a successful attempt to assassinate top Iranian scientist. And I mean, we have seen, particularly since Trump came in, several major attempts to instigate a regional war, a conflict with Iran. If you remember, there was the assassination of one of the top generals in Iran just about a year ago. You recall that, and several other major, very provocative attempts to goad Iran into engaging in an actual conflict with the United States, with Israel, and these other Gulf states like Saudi Arabia, which are in alignment with Israel and the United States on this. So I ask her, what is the purpose of the United States backing an assassination of a very important figure in Iran? What does that actually serve, especially as we're winding down to Trump leaving office in January? It's a very provocative geopolitical move in light of the fact that Trump is leaving very soon. So, you know, what is the actual purpose of doing this? And she gives her answer to that. So we're in very, very, I would say, very dangerous territory right now, whether it's we're talking about the election, whether we're talking about Trump's fascistic base of followers that are prone to violence, terrorism, I would even say, and also what's going on geopolitically with Iran and Israel and these Gulf states. You know, whether you're talking about a geopolitical level or just sort of domestically, we are just in a very precarious moment. You know, a lot of things could happen and a lot of things could flare up. And Marjorie's very clear-eyed in her analysis of these subjects. So I really appreciate her for coming on and providing some of that analysis for myself and for the listeners. So if you would like to learn more about Marjorie, I would ask that you go to her website, marjoriecohn.com. And that's Marjorie, that's M-A-R-J-O-R-I-E, Cohn, K-O-H-N.com. You go to that website and you'll just learn more about her work. And also I'll be providing a link to her Truth Out articles, which she posts fairly regularly on that website. So I'll be putting that and also links to her most recent book, Drone and Targeted Killings. And she has other books as well, and I'll be putting just a link to that down in the description. If you would like to learn more about my podcast specifically about this project, I would ask that you go to my website, lastbornthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support this work monetarily, there are a few options available. First, you can just do a one-time donation through PayPal. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. You can donate through there, or you can also donate on Venmo, and you can find me at Lastborn Podcast. If you would like to support this project regularly on a monthly basis, you can do that through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastbornin the wilderness. And there, if you donate however much you want a month, you'll gain early access to these interviews before they are released publicly, and you'll gain access to some other exclusive content there as well. And I would like to thank all of my patrons. Thank you very much for supporting my work in this way. And also just thank you to everybody who subscribes, who shares this podcast, who sends me their feedback and their insights. However you do, I see that and I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your support. All right, everyone, without any further delay, here is my interview with Marjorie Cohn. Well, Marjorie, thank you very much for joining me for this interview. I've been familiarizing myself with your work. I actually think I came across your work a little while ago, and it was like a note I had made in my mind to maybe potentially follow up and send an interview request your way. But especially right now with the election here in the United States, the presidential election and the fallout of that, and just what we're witnessing with Trump, the Trump administration, the Trump campaign, and everything since then, I've been really wanting to talk with somebody who really understands the dynamics of what's happening. I feel a bit like I'm a layman. I don't quite understand this whole electoral process as much as I thought I did. And I think with what we're seeing Trump and the Trump campaign doing right now, as far as, I mean, you've said in a recent article that you published on your website as well as on Truthout that Trump is attempting an electoral coup at this time. And this was published several days ago, maybe even a couple weeks ago at this point that you published that article. I just want to ask, I mean, you know, you wrote that Trump is attempting an electoral coup. I mean, how would that even be possible? And how is his team or his administration or campaign attempting to pull off a coup? You know, how does that actually work and what's actually happening in regards to that?
Well, for months, Trump was preemptively setting the stage to claim voter fraud. He knew that Democrats would by and large vote by mail ballot because they were careful and didn't want to go to the polls and subject themselves to the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And his supporters, whom he encourages not to wear masks and not to socially distance, would go to the polls. So he began claiming that there was going to be voter fraud, that animals were going to vote, that dead people were going to vote, that mail ballots were fraudulent. And of course, we've been voting by absentee for years with no problems at all. Sure. And voter fraud has been proven to be a totally specious concept. But then when the results came in on election night and it looked like he was ahead because the mail ballots hadn't been counted, he claimed victory and said, let's stop the counting. And of course, as the counting went on, Biden won, and he will not accept that. So his legal team have filed frivolous lawsuits. They started alleging fraud, and then when judges, even Republican judges, were throwing them out of court saying, where's the evidence of fraud? They're limiting it to technicalities, but none of these things would really change the outcome of the election. So then his next line of attack was to delay the certification of the votes, to keep the certifying boards, the certification boards in the various counties and then states from certifying the election. Well, that didn't work. Big law firms were withdrawing from representing him. The Department of Homeland Security said it was the most secure election in American history. Director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency was fired because he said that there was no manipulation of the electoral system. Now, William Barr, his attorney general, who has walked in lockstep with Trump from the beginning, even before the beginning, and done his dirty work, said he didn't see any massive voter fraud. And that was after the election. And Trump strong-armed him. And so he put out a directive saying that his prosecutors could investigate substantial allegations of voting and vote tabulation irregularities. But just recently, a day or two ago, Barr said there is no massive voter fraud. There's no evidence of it. So Trump is furious with him. He may well fire Barr, even though there's only 7 weeks left in Trump's term, just to punish him because Trump is so vindictive.
Sure.
And so basically, the Constitution gives the state legislatures the power to decide how the electors are selected. And the federal code requires that electors be chosen on election day. But it says that when a state has failed to make a choice on election day, then the electors may be appointed on a subsequent day in such a manner as the legislature of the state may direct. But the states didn't fail to choose the electors on Election Day because as a result of the voting process, which ended on November 3rd, Biden won more electoral votes. And there was some manipulation going on. Two of the Republican officials on the four-member board of canvassers in Michigan's largest county that includes Detroit voted against certification of Wayne County's vote count. But then, after a powerful public outcry and accusations of racism, they backed down, reversed their no votes, and then unanimously certified the tally. Meanwhile, Trump called them and spoke with them, and then they tried to rescind their yes votes, and the governor said basically that's too late. So that didn't work, and the electors have been certified for Biden. So now this is what's going to happen now.
Okay.
On January the 6th, the House and Senate will meet in a joint session. The newly constituted Congress having been sworn in, and they have to pass judgment on the Electoral College vote. The Electoral College vote will be on the 14th of December and will go Biden's way. What will happen is that a very tiny number of Congress members have the power to challenge the results on January 6th, and Mike Pence, the vice president, will preside over that joint session of Congress. If a single member of the House and a single member of the Senate object to the slates of Biden electors, then the House and the Senate retreat to their chambers, debate for 2 hours, and then vote. And each state's electors are separately certified. So if the Democratic-run House, which will vote to uphold the Biden electors, and the GOP Senate-controlled Senate disagree, that's never happened before, but that will probably give the governors in key states a larger role. And there are Democratic governors in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. So it's a real long shot that this would happen, that Trump could actually get Congress to go his way. And the other thing about the Senate is that it's going to be very closely divided because Mark Kelly was sworn in, a Democrat, took over from a Republican, and the senator who is up for re-election will probably not have taken his seat, the one in Georgia. So it's going to be very closely divided. Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and I think Mitt Romney have all said they're going to uphold the Biden electors. So I think it's a real long shot that the Senate would even vote to withdraw the Biden electors. And it conceivably could end up in the Supreme Court, and that's what Trump was banking on when he rushed the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett on the court to achieve a 6-3 right-wing majority. But that's probably not going to happen. And it's David Perdue is the one who's probably not going to be taking his seat because he's up for re-election. So I think it's a long shot. And since no lower court, even courts with Republican judges, have found voter fraud, and the Trump forces stopped alleging fraud because the judges were yelling at them and saying, what, there's no evidence of fraud. But since there are no lower courts that have said there's fraud, I just can't imagine the Supreme Court, even with the right wingers on it, taking the case. So I don't think that that this is likely. And moreover, in the Faithless Electors case earlier this year, the Schiaffalo versus Washington case, the Supreme Court unanimously said electors are not free agents. They are to vote for the candidate whom the states have chosen. Now, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch indicated in a Pennsylvania case that they might want to reconsider the issue that was raised there, which was about extending the period of time to receive mail ballots, and who knows about Amy Coney Barrett. But I just don't think that there's going to be a majority of the Supreme Court or four justices, which is what it takes to review a case, to agree to review this case and possibly hand the election to Trump. This is not like Bush v. Gore, where it was a very close election and the election turned on a little over 500 votes. This is a different situation. So I think that he is out of luck there. Now, he can refuse to concede defeat. He can refuse to leave the White House. He can refuse to attend Biden's inauguration. He can continue to insist that he beat Biden. He wants to keep control of the Republican Party. And that's why he's using the money that donors are giving him to defend the election to fund his new PAC so he can keep control of the Republican Party, because he said he wants to run for president in 2024. And the other thing that is most worrisome is that Trump could telegraph to his right-wing white supremacist militia groups to mount an armed rebellion. Hopefully that is not going to happen.
Yes, I hope that doesn't happen as well. So thank you for going over that. That really, you laid that out perfectly. I appreciate that very much. Has this ever happened in U.S. history? President, I know that they say this whole thing's very unprecedented, but has there ever been any situation like this before? In U.S. history?
Not to this extent. This is really the first time that we've had, basically, and I don't use this phrase lightly, Patrick, a fascist dictator.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, that there were no problems before. I mean, the racism has always been there. What Trump has done is to unleash the dogs and bring it out into the open. And so his base, and we have almost half the people in this country who voted for him. My feeling is that what put Biden over the edge was Trump's criminal mishandling of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I think that if it hadn't been for the pandemic, Trump may well have won. So he still has a very entrenched right-wing base. We're talking about racists. We're talking about evangelicals, people who just want smaller government, don't like immigrants, anti-abortion people. There's still those people out there, and he wants to control the Republican Party. He's very powerful. And the reason that the Republican lawmakers salute and march and walk in lockstep with him is that they're terrified of him because he's got such a powerful voice with his tweets and everything else that he could ruin their careers and really tar and feather them. So we'll see what happens. We haven't seen the last of Trump, unfortunately, even though he will hopefully leave the White House on January 20th, and he has still not committed to a peaceful transfer of power, and I think he will never concede defeat.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have kind of a two-part question, because the first part of it is you talk about the Republican Party, and he wants to maintain control over the Republican Party. I'm seeing something of a... I'm seeing this in a Democratic Party, too, in a different kind of way, but I'm really seeing a... seems to me a division among Republicans and the Republican Party, the establishment. These are people who want long-term careers in politics, and they've hitched themselves to Trump, and Trump has become so ingrained in Republican politics that when an actual potential electoral coup was actually being floated, I think a lot of Republicans were like, yeah, they kind of sort of said, yeah, maybe there is fraud, and they sort of went along with it. But once it became seemingly to me not very politically, I'm going to use the word politically correct, but that's not the exact right way that I'm trying to say it exactly. But it's, they just sort of saw this as a threat to their long-term political careers. And I started to see this division among Republicans. So I'm curious what your thoughts are, is like what the future of the Republican Party is going to be after Trump, if he leaves, or however this plays out over the next several weeks. But also the other part of this question is the bigger scale here, the bigger scope, which is how this attempted coup is, like, what is the long-term effects of what Trump and his his administration have really been trying to do here? I mean, is there going to be long-term impacts on the integrity, you could say, of the electoral process in the United States as a result of his actions? And it's a bit of a two-part question. I don't know if you could answer those for me, though.
Well, yes. The Republican lawmakers are walking a fine line because, on the one hand, it's clear that the emperor has no clothes and there is nothing. There's no there. There's nothing to Trump's claims of voter fraud. But on the other hand, Trump has a real strong hold on his base, on the millions and tens of millions of people who voted for him and who still support him and who would run into the streets with their semi-automatic weapons and assault rifles, if he gave the word. And so the Republicans understand that, the Republican lawmakers, and they're really kind of between a rock and a hard place. One of the things that's going to be very interesting is to see how the senatorial runoffs in Georgia fall out on January 5th, the day before the Congress meets on the Electoral College issue. Because Trump has said, he doesn't always think straight, of course, but he seems to come out like Teflon. I mean, we'll see if he escapes any criminal liability once he's out of office for all the crimes he's committed. but he has said, the system's corrupt, your votes don't count, boycott the elections in Georgia. Well, I hope they listen to him because that would be great. And the two Democrats would win and the Democrats would take back the Senate. So I think that there is a real division in the Republican Party about that tactic because they want to maintain control of the Senate. But again, they're walking a fine line. And in terms of the long-term effects on the electoral system and the fundamental right to vote, it's too early to tell, but I'm afraid it's going to be devastating. And the casualty here is truth, because Trump lies with impunity every time he opens his mouth, whatever is self-serving at the moment, so much so, and he has such a loud voice, and people know him from reality TV, that people follow like lemmings. Mm-hmm. And when he said that, the election is rigged, he said that also before the 2016 election because he thought he was going to lose. Now, once he won, he stopped talking about the election being rigged, but he couldn't stand the fact that Hillary Clinton got 3 million more popular votes than he did. So he started leveling these lies about, illegal aliens voting, millions of illegal aliens, which is, a bunch of hooey. So I think that Trump is going to, he's also upset with Fox News because they called Arizona early on for Biden. And so I think he's going to probably start a media company to rival Fox News, and that's going to maintain his hold on these millions of people who walk in lockstep with him and follow what he says. So I think we certainly haven't seen the last of him, as I said before.
Yeah. Yeah. I was interviewing a political analyst, several days ago at Jared Yates Sexton, and he does some pretty good work. He described it a bit. He says that Trump's going to be something like the anti-president for the next 4 years. He was using the comparison of there was in the Catholic Church, the Pope, there was the anti-Pope. So it's kind of the shadow government, so to speak, or a shadow Pope. I don't know how else to say this. And he was using that comparison to describe how Trump might operate in the next 4 years, sort of having that strong, as you talked about earlier, this very, very strong, loyal base of support that will, I think there's probably millions of people in this country that are just not going to ever accept the fact that their president lost the election this year. I'm just curious, you talked about a media company and he wants to maintain control of the Republican Party. Do you really see him running for president in 2024?
Well, that's a good question. I don't have a crystal ball, Patrick, but I don't know if he's going to survive because he had COVID.
Yeah.
And even though he had that experimental drug and lots of steroids, it really attacks the vascular system. He can get blood clots, which is not unusual after you've had it. And he's obese. He eats junk food. He doesn't exercise. He could drop dead from, from residual effects from the virus. Yeah. So who knows what's going to happen? Sure. I think it's impossible to tell.
Sure, sure. That's fair. My last question, or the last topic I'd like to get to, is you also wrote an article. It was published just yesterday, in which you published on your website as well as on Truth Out. The title of that is "Trump's Support for Israel's Killing of Iranian Scientists Could Lead to War." On November 27th, Iran's top nuclear scientist was assassinated. Israel never formally claimed responsibility for this assassination, but it's pretty obvious, and they've alluded to it, I guess. And this, this came at a time, like we were just discussing, we're weeks away from the inauguration before the presidency is passed over, the role of president is passed over to Biden. What is the purpose of doing this, of assassinating the top Iranian nuclear scientist right now? What do you think the purpose of that is, as far as how the Trump administration is calculating and scheming with all of this?
Well, Trump has been doing Netanyahu's bidding from the time he took office. And of course, most U.S. presidents walk in lockstep with Israel, but Trump has taken it to a new level. Mm. And my feeling is that Netanyahu and Trump and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia would like to have a pretext to attack Iran, even though Iran does not pose a threat. They don't have nuclear weapons. The only Middle Eastern country that has nuclear weapons is Israel. Mm-hmm. But shortly before the assassination, which of the top nuclear scientist, which was an act of state terrorism, mm-hmm. Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and Netanyahu and bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, all met in Riyadh to strategize about Iran. Pompeo actually flew to Riyadh in a secret trip. Mm. And then Pompeo visited Israel, the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and several Gulf countries, again, to discuss Iran. The U.S. military sent an aircraft carrier back to the Gulf, and B-52 bombers carried out a short notice, long range mission in the Middle East. And so it apparently it looks like Israel they followed the same pattern before the U.S. killed Soleimani, who was the chief general in Iran, mm-hmm. By Pompeo going to the Middle East, traveling, meeting with these countries, that they would like to provoke Iran into retaliating for the assassination of this nuclear scientist to give the U.S. and Israel and or Israel a pretext to attack Iran, take out its nuclear facilities, which have been only used for peaceful purposes. And Iran was complying with the nuclear deal, the Iran nuclear deal, mm-hmm. And doing everything it was supposed to, according to the inspectors and the International Atomic Energy Agency. And yet Trump pulled out of the deal. Netanyahu convinced him to pull out. Biden has said he wants to rejoin the deal. And what Trump and Netanyahu want to do is to prevent that from happening. They don't want Biden to pursue diplomacy with Iran. They want to go in and use military force against Iran. So I think that's what this was all about. But the Iranian president, Rouhani, said that they would respond to the assassination in the proper time. And Rouhani said the Iranian nation is smarter than falling into the trap of the Zionists. That means Israel and the U.S. supporting them. Mm-hmm. And then Rouhani said they are thinking to create chaos. Now, the parliament in Iran voted to stop future UN inspections of Iran's nuclear sites. And if they continue with that, that would probably deep six the deal, the Iran nuclear deal. They have said they're going to increase the enrichment of uranium, which they have a right to do because the U.S. pulled out of the nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens. What Trump and Netanyahu are trying to do is to sabotage Biden and keep the U.S. and Iran from diplomatic relations. And this is of course very worrisome, because a war in that area could have disastrous consequences, not just for the people of Iran, but for the people of the region and for the people of the world, indeed.
Yeah, I just have to step back for a second and just recognize how I don't understand. I cannot put myself in the place of these leaders. You know, I try to understand, like, even though I completely disagree with everything they're doing on ethics, on an ethical, moral level, or any, you know, all of that. But it's like, I just cannot understand how, even on a strategic level, how you could even have a war with Iran. I mean, it's not like Iraq. It's not like Afghanistan. It's not like Yemen. It's not like any of these other countries the United States or Israel is really engaged in armed conflict with. I just can't get my head around that. And I mean, what is the purpose of trying to get into a full-scale war with Iran right now? I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, Israel thinks that Iran poses an existential threat to their existence. I don't think Iran's ever attacked Israel. As I said, Israel's the only country that has nuclear weapons. In terms of the United States, Trump has basically turned over his Israel policy, not just to Netanyahu, but also to Pompeo, Mike Pompeo and Mike Pence, who are self-identified evangelicals. Mm-hmm. And the Christian Zionists believe that Jesus is not going to return until the temple in Jerusalem is rebuilt. And that's going to happen only if it remains under Jewish rather than Palestinian control. And, you know, so this is, and of course, what Jews don't understand when they support this is that if you take this scenario to its logical conclusion, the Jews either convert to Christianity or they get killed. Mm-hmm. But this is what motivates them. And Trump has pandered to his evangelical base, knowing that he needs them to stay in power. And of course, he plays right into Netanyahu's hands. This is really an outrage. And also, there are laws that are being violated: the Leahy Law and the Arms Export Control Act. You're not supposed to. U.S. is not supposed to give military assistance to countries that engage in gross human rights violations. Mm-hmm. And of course, Israel, there are allegations of war crimes against Israel in the International Criminal Court now. But nevertheless, the United States gives Israel $3.8 billion annually in military aid. And Biden's new Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, said that Biden would not tie military assistance to Israel to any political decisions that it makes, period, full stop. And that's also very worrisome. I don't think Biden will go quite as far as Trump has of pandering to Israel, but I think he'll do plenty of it.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you for just explaining this so clearly for me and for people that are going to be listening to this, because I just think there's so much happening right now, and to keep track of everything that's happening is a task. It's almost a chore on a certain level, just to be informed, because it seems very chaotic right now with everything happening. And I suppose some of that's on purpose, like with Trump, and a lot of his tactics seem to be about sowing some sort of chaos and confusion, and that allows him to operate more effectively, and those around him to operate more effectively. But yeah, I just really just wanted to really understand these issues more, and I think you've really clarified a lot of this for me, Marjorie. So thank you very much for speaking with me today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me, Patrick, and thanks for your important work.
Hi, Patrick. How's it going? Aiden here. I'm a Canadian and young man, and I was sent your podcast by someone else, and I very much enjoyed it. Basically, I just listened to your podcast with the guest Tada, who is a dance therapist as well as other things, and you're talking about the cultural soma. Sorry if I'm slipping on the jargon a little bit. And I thought it was very interesting. Occasionally, I did feel myself putting up a barrier, but I told myself to, you know, stick through and listen to it, and there was some really good information in there. I thought that the cultural comparisons between different dance styles was really interesting. However, I did feel the need to contact you and at least try to refute something that he was saying about, or most of what he was saying about white people not being connected to the lower half of their nervous system. So on hearing that, it really struck me, and I got the sense that Tata might have just been throwing around the jargon of the neuroscientific literature without really knowing what he was talking about. And I did look him up, and he's not a neurologist, he's not a neuroscientist, he's not a psychologist, to be fair, nor am I. However, I am a kinesiologist, and I'm, of course, the body is one thing, so I'm pretty familiar with the nervous system, at least in this specific way. So the example I would like to give is that of hockey players. As a Canadian and a white guy, I've played hockey with a lot of white guys, and as we're getting to be young men adults, we got really strong in, like, inner training and doing barbell squats and stuff like that. And as a lot of people know, that to do heavy, like, say 300-pound barbell squats, you need a lot of musculoskeletal strength. But what they don't know is that you also need a lot of neurological innervation to recruit those motor units. So that just means, like, your brain needs to send the signals to all the motor units at once to fire, to lift those huge amounts of weight. And in that very obvious way, these white people in this specific circumstance are very connected to the lower half of their nervous system. So, yeah, I just thought I'd throw that in there. And other than that, like, I love what you're doing, and also respect Tata, because I think that I got the sense that his heart is in the right place, and he's obviously doing good work and helping people. And good luck to you in these times of isolation, et cetera. And yeah, that's it.
Hey, Aiden, thank you very much for that call. It was really interesting to hear your perspective on that subject. And yeah, just to say, like, with Tata is a dance therapist and, as they say, a cultural somatics practitioner and teacher. And I released that episode, it's about a week ago now. And, you know, I want to first state that when I talk on this podcast, and I think with Todd as well, I mean, when we talk about subjects like this, there is a lot of generalizations that are made. You know, there's always going to be exceptions, right? Like when we talk about race, white supremacy, things like this, there is a lot of generalizations that are often made, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but there's a lot of things that could be missing in those generalizations. Like you said, there are, you talk about how you are aware of an exception to the rule in a certain way. And I don't even know if it would count as an exception, because, you know, I would say, like, with Tata, and I can't speak for Tata, I want to be clear. I'm actually kind of curious if maybe Tata would be interested in responding to this. I'll contact them and see what they think about that. But as far as my response, in a very general sense, I think white culture, whatever white culture is, the cultural soma that is whiteness, you know, I speak as a white person. I'm someone who I can tell you is not nearly as connected with my lower nervous system as I think I should be, or as much as I like. I compare myself. I've been to places in the world where it's obvious to me that it's not just like cultural differences. It's not just language barriers. It's not just that, but there's just this actual thing that you can observe in other people that are not white, that just, they just move differently. Like, there's a way that in which they operate in the world and move through the world, which is just different. And it's not about, like, I'm not trying to apply a value judgment to that per se, but there is something to be said about that. And particularly with dance, you know, I think, as you referenced there, Tata and I talk about dance and how in general, European descendant people, white people, tend to be less connected and focused around the hips and the legs in as far as their dance goes. And not to say that that isn't involved at all, in my opinion, but to have that really deeply connected, rooted relationship with that part of the body is, I think, largely missing from white culture and white people in general. And again, that's a general statement. And I know there are exceptions, and you pointed to one, which is an interesting one. And it involves weightlifting. And I lift weights. I'm not like doing as much weight as you mentioned there with those hockey players. I mean, that's pretty like, that's an intense amount of weight. But I do say, like, when I lift weights and I am engaging the lower half of my body, there is something that's happening there where I'm like acutely aware of how my nervous system feels when I'm lifting like heavy weights and I'm activating my legs or my lower body. But in no way does that translate to how I walk, how I eat, how I dress, in general, how I feel about my body and my relationship with my body, except that I just feel kind of strong. You know, I feel a little stronger because I'm able to do that. So I think technically you may be correct in saying that, yes, we all have these nervous system. We all have these connections to that lower part of our nervous system, but how we engage with it in a day-to-day life and day-to-day basis is up for debate, or it's up for interpretation as far as what Tada presented in that episode I did with them. I don't know. I'm kind of just talking out of my ass a little bit because, again, I'm not an expert in this at all. I merely am curious about cultural somas and how they impact and affect whole groups of people in how we relate with the world and how we engage with our own bodies. And I can say, just based on my understanding of cultural somatics, speaking with Tada, as well as Dare Sohei, who I interviewed previously, I do really think that there is this lack of engagement with certain aspects of our bodies. And there may be channels, and there may be almost like subcultures or these subgroups in which, like within white people, for instance, culturally speaking, in which they do engage more with that lower part of their body. But in general, again, speaking in generalities, I don't see that. I don't really see a lot of that kind of connection or relationship with those part, that part of our bodies. Again, in this, you know, you could probably apply this to people that are like not white. You know, I think it really just stems from colonization, and white people are colonized. We are a deeply colonized group of people, and that's why we have this whole concept of being white at all. Like that's where it stems from, right? And I think other groups of people that have been colonized, and this thing that Tada points to as well with referencing their Japanese ancestry, is as Japan became more westernized, there was a significant shift in their individual and collective relationships with their own lower body. So I think the whole process of colonization is a somatic process. And that's the real point, you know, that's the real point of that. So I'm not trying to say that you're wrong, Aiden, at all. You're actually probably, you're just presenting a nuanced kind of refutation of what Tada presents in that interview. But I would say in general, I think Tada's stance on that still holds. But I get your point. I really get your point. And, you know, for instance, like, I know white people that are doing this kind of somatic work, and they are engaging with their lower body. They're engaging with their hips more, and they're actually doing work, somatic work, to decolonize the body. I know people like this, and they're white. You know, they have same, you know, European ancestry as more or less that I do, but they've just come to terms with how colonization has impacted people of European descent, and particularly those that are in the what we would call North America, right? You know. So I think there's all kinds of ways that we can decolonize our bodies and engage in that kind of somatic work. I'm interested in that right now. And this is just part of the deeper work that I've been doing in discussing colonization and the process of colonization and how we've come to this point. So yeah, Aiden, I really thank you for that call. And if anybody else wants to do what Aiden did, as far as leave me a voicemail that I can feature on the podcast or not, if you just want to send me a message, just let me know if you want it to be included or not in the podcast. But you can call the phone number 208-918-2837. Or you can go to my website, lastbornin the wilderness.com, and there you'll find a link to drop me an audio file directly. That's also an option. So if you're like outside the United States or wherever, and you don't want to call a U.S. phone number, you can do it through that as well. That's another option. So anyway, Aiden, thank you very much for your call. And thank you all so much for listening to this episode. I hope you all have a great week, and I will be back soon with more content. All right. Have a good one. Thanks.